3:45 on the 3rd of December, and we're having a little session here on fundraising for congregations and nonprofits. And my name's Howard Olson. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm a retired businessman now working for Augsburg College and Development Department to raise money. Seems to me I've been fundraising most of my life. I've been active in many, many church campaigns over the years in one manner or another, so I think we're all acquainted with fundraising as we go along. The discussion groups that hold it here are reliant on the people attending the discussion, so I'd like to conduct this in a manner that we have a dialogue so we determine what the interests of some of us are here and what we want to talk about and spend our time in the best manner possible. I notice that people here like a little touch of humor because it gets a little dry in here at times. And I'm listening to some of these tapes from other years, and I heard a couple of stories. I read one the other day, but heard a new one about a month ago. But the minister was walking down the street, and he saw one of his parishioners coming along, really bedraggled and just down and out. So he called him aside, and they had a little visit. The fellow said, "Just everything's going bad with me. The business is bad. Everything's off, and everything." And the pastor said, "Well, I've found once in a while in my career that you just open the Bible and close your eyes and put your finger on a passage there," and he says, "invariably it works out to give you some good advice." So about 6 months later, he's down the street again, and here comes this same guy down the street all dressed up in a new $500 suit and new shoes and moving along. And then the pastor got him aside again. He said, "Hey, what happened?" He says, "You look great." "Hell," he said, "everything just going wonderful." He said, "Well, did you take my advice about opening your Bible, putting your finger on something?" He said, "Yeah, that's exactly what I did." So the pastor says, "If you don't mind my asking, where did your finger land? What was the passage there?" He says, "No, I'll tell you." He says, "It was chapter 11. That tells you something, doesn't it? Yeah. Age we live in. Well, I thought first we'll go around the room and find out what part of this you're interested in, because it's such a broad subject. There's all kinds of fundraising for all kinds of organizations, including our churches and religious groups. And, why don't you just introduce yourself and tell us where you're from, how many times you've been to Holden, and what your interest in money is.
I'm really Conrad Sorensen. I go by Connie Sorensen. I'm in development at Oak Brook Lutheran Bible Camp. This is our 17th trip out.
17th.
But what I'm mainly interested in are, my pastor asked me the other day if I'd help him with some stewardship program at the church.
Okay.
And I've been working with our Bible Camp for 20 years raising money, but I'd like to get some help on what works in congregations today.
All right.
Hi, my name is Ron Backman, from Olympia, Washington. Been up here about 10 times. I'm on the board of Glory Day Lutheran Church in Olympia. And,
that a big church?
About 900 members.
Good size.
So I just was, fundraising is always a difficult area. And one area I was interested in probably is just the annual budget, you know.
Okay.
Well, I'm Rice Grindy. I've been up here a number of times. I think I've missed one year in the last 26 years. We've been around a while.
You get the record here, 25
but
years.
But I've never had any trouble raising money, so I just come here today to listen to what's going on.
Well, you're the kind of guy we want in the meeting if you never get trouble raising money.
Well, I'm Firth Chu. This is my third trip. And I haven't raised too much money for churches, but an awful lot for community theater organization.
Oh, yeah.
And my wife's coming in right behind me here, and she's the one that's running the problem.
You raised money. Yes.
And I'm Shelby Bailey, pastor of a church in Iowa, and we just constantly a matter of trying to raise money for the budget.
For the annual budget?
Yeah.
Your husband just introduced you to the fact that you like to raise money, so we want to know what kind of program you want to be on, learn about.
Who, me?
Yeah.
I don't raise it, I just keep track of it.
You keep track of it, okay. For what kind of organization?
Oh, well, our Savior's Lutheran Church in Spokane.
Okay. And?
And I'm Karen Backman from Olympia, Washington, and my story is the same as his.
I see. You, are there a lot of women involved in the stewardship in your congregation?
Do you think it's 50-50, Ron?
Okay.
I think it is.
Well, I think we'll just kind of start in a rather elementary manner then, and say what's involved in a church deciding to have a campaign, or other than this annual stewardship drive, or we can talk about stewardship drives, but I find the work I do at the college that the many times people come along and they say, we need to raise so many dollars. In other words, they're outlining their needs. They're not saying whether the constituency will support that many dollars or not, or how much you can raise. And the first thing that's missed by many organizations when they start thinking about having a campaign is doing the preliminary that's so necessary to set the tone of the campaign. But then the real thing on most major campaigns anyhow is to determine how much money you can raise. And in the fundraising business, they call it a feasibility study. And some years ago, I was working for, as the executive with the Lingblumson Nursing Home in St. Paul, and that's owned by 25 congregations. And they'd never done any, what I call sophisticated fundraising. So I had to work pretty hard to get the board to appropriate $20,000 to hire an outside agency to come in to do a feasibility study. They needed, they could use about $3 million. Naturally, they wanted to put a new dining room on, another wing, and so forth. So they took it, and they agreed, and we hired this company, and they did the feasibility study. In doing a feasibility study, those companies that do that also will run a campaign for you if you hire them. But we told them we wanted it independent. And you have to outline what you expect from them. We paid them $15,000, and you give them a list of what you think are your potential donors, and they begin by interviewing people, and they do it in a very subtle way and find out if you think the church needs a new wing or something like that. And you know, their last question is, you feel that you'd probably support it to the tune of $25,000 or something. But you have to, when you do a contract like that with a feasibility company, your stipulations have to be pretty firm, so you tell them what you expect them to do. They may come in and guarantee they'll make 100 interviews, and then they may only make 60 or 70 in your time, and they say, well, we're running out of time, we got these 60 for you. You stick them to 100, that's fine. Second thing we did, we told them, now we want these interviews to be made by seasoned people that are mature and understand the program. We don't want you to hire young people that just run out and make a fast interview. We want an interview of quality to be made. If they do that right and they write a good report for you, then the last estimate, last part of the report is they'll tell you conceivably, in their opinion, how much money you're going to be able to raise. In that case, they had estimated $1.7 million. So we took their report, which we then owned, and invited in three fundraising companies and shared the report with them and said, here's our constituency, this is what we have and everything. What are your estimations? Well, one of the companies that we hired is Arvid Bidney, and he's been a successful raiser for the seminary. And we knew he knew a lot of the same people, Norwegian people living in the upper Midwest there, who's many of them had relatives at the home. And Bidney said, I think you could raise about $2 million or a little over. So we ended up hiring his firm at any rate and went on for a year, and we ended up with $2.5 million. It was a good program. And when you hire an outsider, there again, you got to stipulate exactly what you're going to pay for and what you're going to get. And not saying they're fast or not, but if you arrange with them that they're going to have a full-time secretary on the job and they're going to have a full-time director of the campaign, along with your own people, well, you have to kind of track it so you see if you get everything you want.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
On the first, when you said they were going to call on 100 people and they only call on 60, what do you do then? Renegotiate what you're going to pay them then?
Now, if you were at 10,000, say, okay, you get 6,000, make the other 40 calls or something.
Okay.
So that's my first experience has been with many congregations, for instance. I don't think many of them do a feasibility study normally. Have that been your experience? I was chairman of the building committee for Lake Tacoma's Lutheran Church in Minneapolis many, many years ago. That was one of my first experiences of fundraising. But we didn't do a feasibility study. We had the church planned and then figured out how much it was going to cost. And that was in 62, and the cost was about $700,000, and it was a working man's community, and it seemed way too high, but the pastor kept saying he was a good leader, an inspiring guy, and we decided to go ahead with it. So we interviewed three commercial fundraising companies. I was on the council at the time, and that was the first big debate, was whether we should do it ourselves or hire an outsider to come in. And I've always, ever since then, I've been in favor of hiring outside firms to come in. And we hired this firm from Chicago. They did the best-selling job, I think, with us. And they didn't have any qualms. They said, oh, you should be able to raise that much money here. A lot of the people worked for Minneapolis Moline, which was about to close up about 2 years later, you know, and we had these three-year pledges. But that guy was a real stemliner for running a campaign. And I recall when he first came in, he said, okay, we'll have to have this much office space and all this, and we'll need like 30 captains. We said, 30 captains? We only got 30 donors, you know. But the day goes on, he's went at it really good, subtle, and he even helped the pastor develop some phrases for his sermons, you know, about taking part in this campaign and getting with it. And he helped with the letters we sent out. He helped with the bulletins that we put together. And then he had I'm not a big guy on gimmickry, but this guy had it. He came with a whole suitcase full of red neckties. And after you made your pledge, you got your red necktie and you wear it to church every Sunday. And so, after we got the captains, we had to recruit the workers. You had to get five workers for each captain. So we had, you know, about 100 people involved before we even started the campaign. And if you come to church and you made your pledge and didn't wear your necktie, that was a $1 fine. You had to put money in the box. And I thought it was just kind of horseplay, but it really worked. It got to be a joke when finally the pastor could say, yeah, I see a lot of red neckties out there this morning. That's a great sign of this congregation. And that's the way it worked. And it turned out to be a very successful campaign. And we had 3-year pledges, but at the end of 3 years, we went back to that firm, and they helped us in an effort to get most of the people renewed the pledge for another 3 years. We didn't ask them to give more. We just said, we still got a big mortgage. We'd like to work it out in 3 years more to do it. You get a lot of funny things come to you when you work with some of these, as you fellow, you people have all probably experienced church campaigns like this. One fellow was from a small town in Minnesota. He was telling about when it came time to burn a mortgage, they still had a lot of notes payable with various members of the congregation. So they had the mortgage burning dinner one evening, the fireplace was there, fire was burning nice. They had the mortgage that was paid up there with the people, so they put the firm in the mortgage room. They burned the mortgage. Well, then a couple of guys with these notes receivable sitting in the audience for $10,000. That's a good idea. I'll throw mine in it. But not a gimmick to this business of raising money, I guess. Well, there are a lot of steps in this, so I just wondered if you'd like to get a little participation here.
Have you been doing anything with the annual stewardship program?
Yeah, we can talk about it. Okay. What are the steps if we're going to have? Let's just talk about annual stewardship then, okay? Does everybody do it in the fall at the time?
We don't do it at all.
You don't do it? Okay. You do it at your church?
Well, we got a new pastor, and the other pastor wouldn't talk about money. It's a...
How's your budget?
Huh?
How's the budget going?
Excellent. But he said, I don't want anybody to ask me for money, and I don't want to ask for money. So that didn't go on in the church. But we got a new pastor now.
Do you have pledge cards and every Sunday?
No.
You know, that's another system.
But I don't think they're nearly touching what their potential is.
That's exactly right. You have?
We do. I've done a number of things, but the last year they pledged, it went in an envelope, went to the, went forward.
To the altar?
To the altar.
Nobody ever saw it?
At the end of the year now, we'll mail it back, so we don't know what anybody pledged.
We've done that.
What do? Your church? You have envelopes, pledges?
We really don't have pledges. And we just put out what we need and say, let's get it, folks. And we get it somehow.
Do you have, near the fall when the budget is low, running low, do you have meetings or do you make announcements that we need, the money's running low?
We make announcements.
Yeah.
We make announcements every once in a while.
We have a monthly report showing.
I do that too. We have about a monthly report, and then we send out receipts every quarter of what the people have been given.
Okay.
We have comparison of budget with actual giving. You know, we do have our budget at the beginning of the year.
How about you?
Never had any problems. In the 22 years that I've been with the Lutheran Church in Sandwood, it's only been once ever been mentioned.
They use the pledge card? They don't have pledges or stewardship
no.
Sunday or any of that?
No.
What?
I did have a bad experience though. I was in a big church in Seattle, First Lutheran.
Uh-huh.
And they hired one of these professional fundraisers. They split the congregation.
Yeah, that'll happen.
And
you mean just for an annual fund drive or for a special drive? I mean, like for building a church or
no?
Just for
if you have a cost, there's never any problem. If you have to build something, it's this was a special drive, but it sure split the congregation.
Yeah, a lot of people. Well, let's just go back a couple of stories. Many people don't believe in pledging.
Yeah.
Many people don't believe in bringing in an outside party with a one-man consultant or a firm and paying them money to tell you how to give your money to the congregation. And you're right, you've got to get a kind of unanimous vote on that before you do it, otherwise you are going to lose people, you're going to lose supporters.
Well, we're kind of unique in the way we got a few people that are pretty well loaded. They own a freezing plant there, and usually if it looks like the budget isn't quite going to make it to the end of the year, well, they see through that it gets made.
Okay, you all know what that means, 80% of the people 80% of the money comes to 20% of the people. Mm-hmm. Now in national trends, they say it's more like 90 and 10. And that's what happens. Congregations get reliant on, you know, half a dozen or 10 people or something like that, and they're getting most of the money. And that's not the healthiest situation in the world.
Just heard the other day it went from 95 to 5.
95 to 5 now?
What?
Well, the question becomes, how do you get that other 95 how do we put it nicely?
Participate.
What's that arena You know, Scotland, Scotland is a member of Shepherd of the Hill, no, Good Shepherd Lutheran in Minneapolis. The word around that congregation, let Scotland handle it. And the pastor even had a sermon on that. Can't let Scotland handle it any longer. Scotland was the president of a very large insurance company in Minneapolis, and he liked to do good charitable things, and St. Olaf got a beautiful athletic center. In that case, they just kind of practically told Scotland, we're not going to take that much from Scotland. We think you all ought to participate in the annual budget. But I'm amazed that so many of you, I know that many times country churches will do that. They don't have a pledging system or anything. And then they make appeals near the end of the year, and people come through, or when the harvest is in or something. The churches I've been in, we have a real hard time getting a decent budget when you don't have pledges. If we take our pledges, if the pledges are $500,000, that's the basis of our budget for the next year.
After we do it the other way around.
Well, we have taken pledges. Go ahead.
We do the budget, and the people come through and support the budget. Whatever we need, we don't go with what the people are going to, and build our budget around what they're going to give.
Well, we put out a budget one time and took some pledges, and we got in about what amounted to about 25%
of the budget.
Of our budget.
So,
and so that told us right there that the pledging system wasn't going to work. And the treasurer got awful nervous when she got through the year.
Yes, I understand that. Very
this
well.
One church I was in, we had a factor for people that don't pledge but give regularly. Mm-hmm. And we knew who they were and approximately how much they'd give. So we kind of cracked that into our budget.
That one fundraising that we had, I can remember, in about 22 years, the preacher didn't ask for any money. He just talked about the theme was pretty much the need and for the giver to give.
That's right.
Well, rather than asking for anything.
I got one here. It says, the faith of our giving. This is a Quaker bulletin, but they talk about the motive. We didn't yearn for the thank yous, instead seek the opportunity simply to give. You don't need a motive to give. Christians shouldn't need a motive. It's easier to raise money for a stained glass window than it is for the furnace or the underground parking lot. So the incentive is there. You've got a good incentive in Bible camp.
Brick and mortar too helps if you got a cause. It's easier to raise money for the building than to raise it to send to the home office.
That same building program I was on, one of the bishop told me, he said, a new church building should not be a tool of evangelism, but it seems to work that way.
Yeah.
Well, it sure gets you to do an every member visit.
We'll get to that. I think I was going to get into that in a minute or two. The thing about a driver building a new building, is the wonder of it is this. In that church, we had a budget. I don't know what the budget was. It was about, say, $75,000 a year, and this is required to be $150,000 a year. And these fellas convinced us, you'll never go back to 75. When you're done with the 150, you might be going to 140 or 135, but you are in a new plateau of giving because of this building program. And that's the way it stayed that way, too. And then church grew and grew after that. Let's talk a minute about the three, tell me a few ways of getting annual pledges. Here's a campaign right here. Just totally no pledge, huh? Let's call it the no pledge, just volunteer. You got a name for it? Or?
No pledge.
No pledge.
Some would say faith giving.
Faith giving, okay. No pledge, that's one. Two is a letter goes out to the, with an envelope. Does anybody have pledges? Oh, you have pledges without envelopes, without weekly envelopes?
Oh, we have weekly envelopes.
You have weekly envelopes.
Yeah.
But yours, where they send in their pledge and it's put on the altar, You have envelopes with that then? Or?
No, well, we send envelopes out.
Yeah.
But
you don't know what the pledges are, so. Let's put
blind pledges.
Yep. Now, do you do it by way of send out letters, or sermons, or pick up your pledge card after the service, or how do they get the pledge card? Dinner?
Don't worry, they did pick them up once for the whole year.
It was at one time. This last time we had a, I can't remember what the theme was, but they had a, they built about 40 houses.
Birdhouse
type, and they were all teamed around to different members. And
sort of the team.
But I can't remember how they got to the altar.
They were home visits. Is what they were.
They were home visits. Yeah, that's the key right there. We'll put that.
Is
that? Well, one approach is the Pony Express.
Yeah, the Pony Express.
Yeah.
We've used that.
The saddlebag went from house to house.
That's when you get it, and then you take the next person?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And somebody can't find it with a packet, they put it under their mattress, and that's the end of the ride. What we did one time, and I've checked this out with some of the other people I worked with too, they tried the Pony Express. And then before the Pony Express, there was another system they had where
every member visits.
No, that's what we're coming to. That the there was something where you didn't visit. You didn't have a campaign. In other words, it was anyhow. They tried that system and that system for 3 years. But then the third year, they went to the every member visit. And the pledges went up considerably. There's something about eyeball to eyeball, friend to friend, member to member, visiting in the living room. Every member visit raises more money and pledges year after year than any other system. I know people in congregations get tired of it every year and it seems to come around too fast. You got to organize the teams and do it. And that's why you go on these other methods. But the every member visit is the way to raise the most money. But that takes a lot of organization, you know.
Another way for that every member visited our church was they would choose a family in a neighborhood who would invite maybe 8 or 10 yeah. other families to come in, and it made many fewer visits. But
cottage meetings, you mean?
Yeah, cottage. That's what they call it, I think.
One of the choices that we're looking at this year is to, it's a company out of Texas, I think it is, and they just encourage everybody to go up, say, 10% on what they gave last year by directly asking.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just in the process of studying that. So,
are you doing that with your own teams? Are you
yeah.
putting together
yeah.
the... What do you think of that? Asking people.
I don't know that program, but a different question. Somebody lately said that the tithing came out of the Old Testament. I don't know if any pastors can answer this. What does the New Testament say about our giving to the church? Is that true that tithing was out of the Old Testament? No. Anybody know?
I don't know exactly
tithing
that.
Tithing is the law, the expected offering that's to be given.
But that,
Jesus used the proportional giving.
But it wasn't always 10%, was it? Somebody told me that 10% came from some other source.
Double tithing, well, that must have come from the New Testament.
Double tithe, is that what you're talking
about? How much is that?
It's 20%.
Good word, thank you.
Hey, double ten. How, do you have, do you identify in your congregation, do you know who the tithers are?
Oh, yeah.
Do you identify them, or do they, do you publicize them or anything?
No.
Some congregations do that. They, well, when they're having a campaign, they have a, you know, a temple talk, and the guy giving a temple talk was, you know, just saying, my wife and I have been tithing for the last 10 years. Oh. Hasn't hurt us, you know?
Yeah, they volunteer.
Yeah.
I was telling him before you, before we started, Church in the Morning in Sioux City, Iowa, had a program that if you tithe for 6 months and you've not been blessed, you get your money back if you want. I've not heard the end of that program.
Let's see, who
I mean, you're talking about gimmicks, and I have a hard time with gimmicks. I mean, it's...
Yeah. Who decides whether it was a blessing or not?
Well, in a smaller church, you end up with the same people going out to see the same people all the time, and they get tired of that, and that's why they say they don't want to have the budgets and do the every number visit.
They say the only time you come to visit us is when you want money.
Want money.
Yeah, that's...
Well, in our church, in most of Scandinavians, and I think when they approved the budget, they got an obligation to meet it, so it was never a problem.
Yeah,
they wouldn't approve it if they didn't intend to meet it.
Well, the problem is, in our church, the annual meeting is attended by about 40 people, and there's 225 adult members in the congregation, and so that's throwing a lot of weight on those who are attending the...
They're probably part of that 10% to give most of the money.
They are. They're the ones that give the money. That's
they
the problem.
Probably wouldn't be there.
That's the problem.
Well, our people are warned ahead of time that if they're not at the meeting, they don't have any they won't have any basis for complaint if they don't like the budget.
Most congregations, the need or the amount of money they need is much greater than what they're able to get pledged every year. So the secret of the trick in good fundraising is to try to determine ways and means and methods that'll elevate the person's, people's giving. And we found that at the college too, where I worked, that we're very cautious about asking someone for $5,000 when they could just well get $50,000. We do a lot of time on that before we start making the ask. And that's the thing that isn't happening, I don't think, from my experience, in many congregations. We want the person to, you know, do as best he can and everything, but we don't say, you know, would you consider your pledge this much this year? Some churches may, but most ones I worked on, the campaigns, and even the workers, they don't want to do that, to go to another party and say, can you, even 10%, you know, it's hard to ask people for another 10%. I have a kind of a joke I tell about that. I was quite a young man. I had an office in downtown Minneapolis, and I volunteered to work for the United Fund. So they said, "We're gonna, you give me some cards here in the A-list." So I had 10 cards there. And they said, "Now, don't leave the card. When you get there, either get the pledge and get it signed and get out of there, but don't leave the pledge card. And ask for 10% more than they gave last year. Consider that." So I look at these cards. One of the cards I had was the president of Honeywell. His name was Sweat. So I went up there and ended up being, and Sweat said, "Oh, you shouldn't have to waste your time coming around on this stuff. You know, give me that card." I looked at his last year's pledge, was $10,000. I didn't ask him to kick it up for 10% more. And that was, he had been the chairman of the drive, I think, the year before, so that's how well that went. But I know a lot of people that fundraisers will say.
Did he up it to 10%?
He probably did.
I'd like to hear a little more from this gentleman. I, you know, I've called on a lot of people and only gotten burned once. You know, somebody got mad at me. Some lady out here that I've been wanting to ask her for a gift for 17 years and I haven't dared out here, she said, "What does your camp need from me?" I've been waiting for 17 years for that, so I have a lot of patience. But one of the things that I think we need from somebody that feels as strongly as you do about it, and I'm not asking you to say that today, I'm not trying to pry into your finances, but I think we need you to help younger people know how to give and the joy of it. And I know most of us Norwegians, they got a pretty tight clamp on our billfold. You know, I understand that. But I really beg some of our major donors, I said, I hope that you're teaching your kids how to give. Because you evidently learned it real young. And some other people.
I think that it's education involved and starting with the young. Yeah. For instance, we got a lot of young people in our congregation just this last few years. It's growing so fast. And the preacher said at one of the council meetings, it takes about five young people to equal the giving of one older one. Well, that shows you right there. They need a lot of education, a lot of training, before they realize that, that instead of being a fifth of what the older person gives, they ought to give a little more.
But I think it's always been a hard topic to talk about money. You know, you talk about talking about your faith to your family. Try to ask your family for gifts to your organization. That's just about as hard, you know. But I think
it's important that they realize what it takes to run the church.
Yeah.
A lot of them probably don't. You don't have to ask for money to educate them what it takes to make the thing go.
When you talk about young people, how I was thinking of, like, you know, kids.
Well, I'm thinking of those 40 and under.
Oh, okay.
The group from about 30 to 50 is a group of generation there that is not much on giving.
No.
We've seen that in college alumni even. They, for some reason, the years they grew up, the atomic threat and everything like that, they never got heavy on giving.
We find that the baby boomers that come to our camp, you know, our rates for camp used to be way down.
Yeah.
Now we raised them up because they'd rather pay for what they're getting than give a gift to it. And that was opposite when we started. You know, people, you'd charge them a little bit for a week of family camp, they'd leave a $100 or $200 check. But now we found they weren't doing that. So you raise your rates up. And so they're paying for what they, and I don't know how you're going to work that in the church. I mean, it's
you in your sermons during the year at 810, you talk much about the need to, as part of your Christian life, to need to be generous.
No, I don't talk about money.
Yeah, well, do you find that, why don't you talk about money? It's a big part of everybody's life.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I'm always interested in what I call stewardship sermons, you know, and some of them are good and some aren't so good, because a lot of pastors don't like to talk about money, so when they do or have to or get involved in a campaign like this, they really struggle with it. But it's money is a reality everybody, you know, knows what they deal with every day of their life and everything.
Well, it's the idea that I hate to talk about asking people to give money. I hate to talk about money. Because I know everybody has a different idea about how they feel about the money.
Do you know which people in your congregation give the most money?
I have a pretty fair idea.
Yeah.
Who gives the money.
We had a pastor once that did not want to know. He absolutely did not want to know who gave what or anything. He just said, you fellas handle that and I'll handle the pulpit and so forth. But he gave sermons and things and talked about it, but he didn't want to know who the big givers were and the light givers.
And you never have any trouble with meeting your budget?
It's always just squeeze it out to the end.
Yeah.
We've ended in the budget or the whack the last several years, but I mean, it's been tight.
What if you had a special project? What if you needed to, pave the parking lot or something?
Let me put it this way. We just got six stained glass windows and they're all paid for.
Okay.
Through memorial fund, through memorials that various people put in memorial money for.
All right, see.
It's all done.
That seems to be the easiest area.
Stained glass
windows. Fixed the organ, stained glass windows, new roof, parking lot.
What? What'd you say?
A bell choir for the girls and children.
What if we had to fix the plumbing? Who's gonna put that in there tomorrow?
That's right.
People don't like to put it into the new roof. They don't want to put it into new carpeting.
They don't understand that, see? They don't understand that the physical plant is falling apart. But it still takes money. We have that problem at the college. The hardest thing at a college raise is the annual fund. You know, you should budget. Our income streams are from tuition, for instance, from the biggest ones from tuition. And we have gifts for scholarships and things, but we used to try to raise about $800,000 a year from an annual fund. And that, we use a telephone campaign, we use letters, we use brochures, and some dinners, all types of things. And it's like pulling teeth every year. Join the President's Club, give $1,000 a year, you know, things like that. But then that money, people don't like to give to, even to nonprofits, they don't like to give to the operating budget. But in the church, that's what the money's for. It is an operating budget.
You have some things against consultants, and I understand that. First, when we had at our camp, we had a $400,000 campaign, and the fundraiser was to get $30,000 out of that. We got to $70,000, the whole thing ended. So he took $30,000, we got $40,000. But our consultant we worked with at our camp for 12 years has taken our annual fund. We have now 600 people that give $100 plus a year, plus 90 that give $1,000 a year.
That's great.
But a lot of those have come through when we've had major appeals, and those people have gotten used to giving.
Right.
And so I think you need to use your stained glass window or those things and people just to reach a higher level. One of our major donors told me once he hadn't learned how to live until he learned how to give. And that's, he's a Baptist that gives to Lutheran King. So.
Things we really work with in our work is that, you know, people seem to need a motive for giving. It's either for self-satisfaction or some reason to give it to a college. We have to find out what they like. They like music? Fine. We try to arrange that they can give the music department. And any donor of substance should be kind of self-motivated. He should be giving to something because that's what he wants to give to, not because that agency needs it. And he doesn't want to give the plumbing system. You're right. The most money they ever raised, the quickest at Holden Village, was in the sewer system, went on to Fritz, and Carol Hindley wrote a letter, said, it failed, we got to get this ready by spring, we need, you know, $50,000, and that one worked just like a dream. The money came in, but it was a crisis, you know.
Well, we have a woman in our congregation who is very good at fundraising. This is really her forte. And she'll, you know, if we're low on the budget and we can't pay our insurance premium, for instance, she'll put on a campaign that she'll call the PIP campaign, Pay Insurance Premium. Mm-hmm. And she's always inventing little acronyms like this. And then she'll report on and pledges to Bloomsday to repair the irrigation, the sprinkler system.
You're really fortunate to have a person like that.
Yeah.
Last church has been, we had a couple of guys that they like to do this. It's a hobby. Mm-hmm. And fall came, time for the stewardship, get lined up, get enlisted, recruit people. That was great. And they had a lot of enthusiasm. That's what you need, you know? People that go after it. You got any of those in your church?
I don't know how many committees we have, just, you know, oodles of committees, but that's one committee. You know, the stewardship committee, that nobody wants to be on. So we give it to the board, and they don't want it either. So.
Yeah, I'm true.
Ever had them sing through that song, Take My Life and Let It Be? Everybody picks their favorite verse.
No.
The one they don't pick is Take My Silver and My Gold.
You know, reasons why people give or don't give, and we get criticized by people, oftentimes they say, nobody asked me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we, in our congregations, if we could get the people, the core people that will ask, that'll help our giving. A place where it's totally, where everything's totally voluntary, like yours and yours, that's fine. But it might be that the level of giving could be raised higher than it is. Because you're just, you know, we, this college I worked for, we had a 10-year campaign to raise $63 million. Most of the alumni are pastors or teachers. Not a very good constituency to work with at all. And prior to that, the most they ever raised was $4 million. Their endowment funds at the time of the campaign started were $1 million. They should have, you know, $50 million. We set a goal of $20 million. We just finished that campaign about 3 weeks ago. We shortened the time from 10 years down to 8 years, so we completed the $63 million in 8 years. But that is tough going, and you really have to do a lot of good work. You have to have a dedicated alumni that will call on alumni and make the ask, and ask for the right level of money. But it's just wonderful to see people that will give money like that. The last one we had, this library, we built a $13 million library. We were $3 million short. And this one fellow had given $2 million, and we'd always thought we'd have a $5 million gift. And we had some meetings with him and said he could stretch it out over 6 or 7 years, and he went for it. And those are just wonderful things, that you see people that are so generous. And a lot of our churches, congregations, have done the same thing. Central Lutheran in Minneapolis, this is about 15 years ago, they decided to start their own foundation, their trust fund. And it was a big argument on congregation, because the guys that wanted the trust fund said, this is what we need, it's kind of an endowment fund, you know. But the others said, no, we don't want to do that, it'll take away from our regular giving. And you always hear that when you're going to have a building program. So, well, they'll give the buildings, they'll cut back on their regular annual pledge. But it doesn't work that way if you work it right. They went ahead with their trust foundation in Central Lutheran. It's now up to about $1.5 million. Throws off about 10% a year, $150,000 that they have going into the operating fund or for special projects. Another church up there, Calvary Lutheran, that Maynard Nelson, you may know him, he was out here in Seattle for many years. He had a group of people in his congregation called the Second Mile. After they got everything done, all the programs of the congregation, everything, these guys said, this is the Second Mile. What are we going to do this year? Let's have something really new. Okay. Let's sponsor a student at Augsburg College, our college from Namibia. Okay, put some money in it, set up a scholarship. They pledged $50,000 to Augsburg College, $10,000 a year for 5 years, just for this Namibian scholar to come. These are the kind of things that we, you know, you kind of think about when you're thinking, what should this congregation be doing, or what can we do something bigger or better than to pay the electricity and the fuel bills? See? So when you get into those kind of things, that it takes everybody, including the pastors, some dedicated people that want to really work at it and think differently, and you've got to convince the congregation that there are bigger and better things they can do in their giving programs. And I know everybody gives to many organizations, but these are some of the things that come from really extensive planning and giving. And we hear the praise, we don't even like to hear it around our office anymore. There's a lot of money out there, which everybody knows nowadays. It may be out there, but we got to get it in here, you know, and that's the trick. What time is it here? We should be closing up pretty soon.
What were these steps you had down here? Were you going to give us that, or?
Well, I had some steps here. I've got a whole part of them. If you have a campaign, I've got many of them. The reason we go to these steps is that so many people, if you had 7 steps, a lot of people will start with step 5. They say, oh, we sent out a letter to our advanced gift. Well, you shouldn't send out a letter to your advanced givers before you take a step 1, see. Step 1, we just said, you know, you gotta get the committee together. Then the feasibility, selection of the feasibility firm, if you're going to do that, or you can do your own feasibility too, you know. But people will talk more freely with a stranger or an outsider than they will with somebody that's from their own neighborhood or their own congregation. And in my mind, that's the best reason to use an outside consultant. They come in, as a matter of fact, on a business basis and just talk facts. Then when you get the report back from the, after you've done your feasibility, then you have to evaluate that, determine what you're capable of seeking. And after you got all that put together, the fifth step is to set the goal. Then you know you're setting a reasonable goal that you know can be attained, and you, everybody knows this, and it's, go work for it. You know, they did this at Holden. They, a fellow came to see me about 2 years ago, and he said, you think Holden can raise $5 million? I said, no. He said, why not? I said, well, I don't think they got a constituency. I noticed the campaign went out at $2 million, and they're over $1.2 million now. So that's for that. Well, then after you do that, you, if you're going to do it yourself, you got to organize all your teams. Select the drive managers, recruit the captains. And the big factor on after you got your whole setup is training. And there, if you didn't use a recruiter or a teacher for anything else, just training them how to make the calls and what to do, how to use the literature, all that. I had a big dinner one night, and I said, oh, I got this all figured out now. We'll put the pledge cards on the table by the plate here, and we're going to have this big hooray and nice talk by the pastor. And that guy said, don't put those pledge cards down there on the table. Oiler at the high steam, when the choir's sung, everything's going good, then you pass out the pledge cards. Get them fired up first. You get a lot more money that way, a bigger pledge. Okay, then you get ready, and then you have the campaign. Say the campaign takes 6 weeks. Then when you close the campaign successfully, you have a big celebration, light the balloons and all that. Now, after that, if there are pledges that are more than 1 year, or even for 1 year, you want to celebrate and acknowledge the donors. And then churches really don't do this quite as well as they should. At the college, we spend a lot of time thanking people and acknowledging their gift in many ways. And then we have what we call the conservation of the pledges, and that is an attracting thing to see that people who have pledged, who said they're going to do so much, actually do it. And in a large scale like ours, we have, you know, literally hundreds of pages of people that may have answered to a, you know, a campaign by telephone, and then they forget about it or something, you got to follow up real quickly. I was on a phone-a-thon one night at Lutheran Brother, and I noticed use their facilities. We had 25 people down there raising money for the National Lutheran Choir. In the middle of the room, they had a secretary and two computers. And we had 20 people making phone calls, 20 different. You call them about somebody, so they'd say, you'd have their card, and they'd say, yes, we will be willing to give $25. The runner comes over, gets that card, puts in the computer, they type out the letters in the mail before midnight. Next day, he's got his card and his letter thanking him for the phone call and thanking that he gave $25, and here it is, put it in the envelope, send it back to us. And then they track that later on, it doesn't come back, it's all computerized. That's what you call a top-notch campaign. But those are the kind of steps, you know, you gotta do. I just made a couple more notes, I'll just run through them briefly here, that different types of campaigns, and then a lot of these don't involve churches, but you know, a capital campaign, that's, if you could just set aside, you need a new roof, parking lot needs painting, a building, that's all capital, keep that away from the annual fund or the stewardship. Operating budget help, we talked about that, and the annual fund and so forth. What do you do if your annual fund, if you've got a budget of $200,000 and suddenly you get $230,000 come in that year? You set it aside, or?
Never had that problem. Because we're pretty close.
See, that won't happen in these churches where you're just meeting your budget every year. You ever come in high? Have an extra 25 or...
I don't think they know what to do with the money.
I've never seen that.
we were over it. When I was on the Holden board 1 year, we were about 30,000 over, you know, and they said, hey, this is a non-profit. You're not supposed to have profits. And they said, we don't call it profit. We call it excess over budget or something like this. Well, then there are endowment funds. You know, colleges live on many endowments and scholarships. And Luther College, I met with the president there when he first came, who's now the Bishop Anderson. And they had a very low endowment, too. And they have a named scholarship there for $12,000. And they had a four-year plan on it. Many families went for that, $3,000 a year for 4 years, built their endowments way up. Then we have, you know, deferred giving. Do you ever do anything? Talk to your people about naming the congregation, the church in the will when they die or leave the farm to the church or any of that stuff?
That happened in a previous congregation.
Uh-huh. We get quite a bit of that at the college. We had one that was pegged at $150,000, came in about $450,000, went through the probate court and everything, you know. We find more and more people that they get older, their family's well taken care of and everything, they want to leave it to the church or to, even when I worked at the nursing home, most of those people wanted their congregation to be named as well as the nursing home. There are all kinds of plans, you know, about deferred giving and that type of thing. You probably get into some of that, don't you? Good. So, thank you all. Has anybody got any other comments, questions?
I think I had one time, you know, they said give till it hurts or give till it feels good, and I gave some money to our college, where I went to Dana College, and my wife and I did, and went up there, and here we saw our name on a little plaque. And that's the first time I really felt good about giving. I mean, when we have a pledge drive at the camp, I don't give the 10, but I give what the normal. But somehow in our life, we have to realize that what we have is not ours. And I don't know how you say that and get people, but you know, all of my money I have, which is not very much, could be wiped out tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
For any of us. And I've had many businessmen, when they get started in business, I say, I'm going to give 50% of what I make to the camp. Then their business gets started and they need money for operating.
That's right.
And I understand that. But I don't know. I guess I learned very young to pledge and give weekly, and that's what's helped me.
Pledging, you know, some strange things happened. When I was at this nursing home, we had this big drive. I didn't believe in phonathons. I don't like them. Somebody's called up and you're having dinner and eating, you want some aluminum siding on your house. So I told them I didn't want one. They said, no, we got to have a phonathon. And they enlisted from these 27 churches that owned that nursing home, they enlisted volunteers in every congregation to make these phone calls, send them out to listen and everything. And they got pledges from people in my own congregation that don't even pledge to the congregation they were giving. So I was wrong. I mean, it shows phonathons are the red button thing. That's why you get so many phone calls now.
Well, our town where we are right now raised $2.5 million for a nursing home.
Okay.
In 3 weeks' time.
Oh, man. Ooh. They must have had a good 20 group or something, huh?
I don't know what they had, but...
What town is that again?
Yeah,
Marcus, Iowa.
Marcus, Iowa. I don't remember that.
Thanks, Howard. Good to know, Iowa. You don't get that one.
And the problem is, the people felt the need for a nursing home, and the state was saying no, there was no need. And the people were saying, yes, there is, and they got the money themselves to build one.
Yeah, isn't that something? That's great. I love to hear stories like that.
Keeps us going.
Here's a fundraiser.
No? Spokane.
He's raised $1.5 million.
I had one comment I wanted to make about your committee that you get long-term gift out of the estates and so on.
Yep.
I think that should be done by a different committee and run separately from the annual budget.
So I think you're right, yeah.
But that is a long-term proposition. And it's got to be done by somebody that you know is going to be around for a long, long time and carry it on.
Because most churches don't, most congregations don't really get into that.
No, I know that. But
if you got an insurance man or two in your congregation, and you talk to them, you get them to start to piece it together, they're really good programs. To help the congregation and to help the people in the ministry.
Well, it really should be done for a thing like building a building or something that, rather than for the current budget.
One lady in my previous congregation left her estate to the church in a a living trust. And when she died in 1981, the church was getting about $1,000 a year off of her, about 35% of her estate income. And this last year, they got $7,500 off of it.
Wow.
Just the value of the return on the investment had gone up that much.
That was a nice thing to have.
I just got to talk to a member just within the last month that was telling us that.
Yeah.
What's the figures of $8 or $13 trillion that's going to turn over the next 20 years between generations? It's fabulous.
Inheritance.
Yeah.
One thing about giving, when I worked at the nursing home, the giving annually in America was about $92 billion. And the tax rules changed and everything, everyone said that's going to hurt giving. Now, last year, the giving in America was $130 billion. Nowhere in the world do they give money like they do in America. No. Most of it, and most of it's because of churches, to churches, because it's an annual, a weekly gift type thing.
I've made up thousands of individual income tax returns for the county firm that I work for, and I made a study over a 2-year period of the people who use the actual deductions instead of the standard deduction, and the big item on the actual deduction was always contributions, and the top item on their contributions was always their church.
There's something written once about the amount claimed and the amount given was a little different.
Well, that's another story.
Yeah.
Thank you much.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.